Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
I, of course, am Andrew Gellos. With us this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be back. I feel funny after missing a week.
This episode, we will be continuing with our ongoing recap of A Knife of Dreams. That being said, it should be fairly obvious by now that not only will we be talking about the 11th book of the Wheel of Time series, we'll probably be discussing things that have happened in all currently existing 11 books. Therefore, if you have not read that far, you might want to tune out until you catch up in the series. There will be spoilers.
So we begin this episode with our summary of Chapter 12, A Manufactory. This particular chapter is mostly from Perrin's point of view, and I actually find it one of the most interesting chapters in this book. And it begins with Talonvor mediating 3 days of discussions between Perrin and Banner General Tylee Kirgon of the Seanchan. In the end, she agrees that Perrin's plan for rescuing Fael and getting rid of Shaido is the best plan. The Seanchan are extremely touchy about protocol, and it takes them some time to arrange the numbers of people in the party and so forth. To start the plan, Niald opens a gateway from Perrin's camp to the town of Almizar in the southwest Almedicia. Perrin, accompanied by Seben Balwer and 12 of Fael's followers, ride through. Because he is afraid that Aram will tell Massima about what they're doing, Perrin elects to leave Aram behind. Kirgan is accompanied by Mishima, a Suldam Andamani, and 12 Seanchan soldiers. Perrin thinks of Matt and sees an image of him riding into the forest. There are numerous Tinker caravans camped near the town, and Elias had told him that such large gatherings are rare except at their annual Sunday meetings. Niald scoffs at the Tinkers for cowards, but Perrin defends them, telling how they protected the children of Emmon's Field when Trollocs attacked. Balwer and Midori slip away to scout the town. There is a rock and landing field just north of the town. Perrin and the Seanchan enter a large farmhouse that serves as the Seanchan military quarters. The commander is Captain Blasik Falun, a former flyer. As Kirgan asks to speak with him in private, a clerk named Metan vomits beetles until only his skin is left. Everyone is in terror, shouting that it is Soulblinder's work. Falun orders another clerk, Atal, to clean up the mess, then escorts the newcomers to his office. Tylee Kirgan demands some of his flyers, and after Perrin shows Suras' letter, they agree on 4 Rakan and 12 Morat Rakan, along with a ground crew. Falun also happens to have a fine map of Altara that he gives them. Perrin wonders if this is Taviran work, but he isn't sure. Perrin and the others head into town to get Forkroot and the Idom that they need. Balwer has not yet learned who rules Almedicia now that Alron is dead. There are also Hunters of the Horn in town. Perrin recalls that Moraine had the Horn of Valyr carried to the White Tower. A man notices Perrin's eyes as they're in the street and darts away in fear. Kirgan leads them to a stone stable, which is a Forkroot manufactory. Using Suras' letter, they convince the Seanchan noble, a lesser hand in charge, to give them all the prepared Forkroot that she has, almost 5,000 pounds. As they leave, Perrin turns in his saddle just as an arrow glances off of his chest and pierces his arm. Mishima takes off for the men on top of a nearby building where he believes the arrow came from. Kamila and Barmanis remove the arrow, and Kirgan apologizes for not protecting him better. Niald comes forward, but Perrin tells him to wait for healing until later. Kirgan is shocked that he would let someone use the one power on him. When Mishima returns, he tells them how the men on the roof took poison and are already dead. Perrin thinks it might be the work of the Forsaken, but he doesn't mention that to Tylee and Mishima. They then head for an inn so that Niald can heal Perrin.
I honestly think that in a lot of these particular chapters, Robert Jordan really wasn't pulling any punches at all. He got the information out really quickly. and was pretty obvious. Anytime someone in these middle chapters sees one of the boys and suddenly leaves with no explanation, it's usually a direct indicator that there's going to be an attack by Dark Friends at some point in time. Spencer and I mentioned this in the last podcast, when the one person got up and left the dicing game with Matt in a Helen Mattern. It's just one of those things that, at this point, now that they've been given free rein to attack Matt and Perrin, the Forsaken pretty much aren't holding back at all. They're going to send strikes after them almost consistently whenever they are able to. And it's just something to be expected. One of the things that really got me was the entire, like, vomiting up scarabs. And honestly, the scarab is probably the closest thing that in imagery. I just have many images from, like, the various mummy movies and whatnot in which people are consumed or, you know, have been incubating scarab beetles for quite some time until they, like, suddenly are just completely left with nothing but, like, their skin or their skeleton or something. And it's just, I always thought that was amazingly creepy, and to see it appear here is just like, oh, okay. Yeah, that is definitely either the Dark One's touch or a huge bubble of evil.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, that is really beyond creepy. And it's amazing to me how I know that Perrin is completely focused on Fayol to the exclusion of almost everything else, but he just takes these things as a matter of course. I mean, beyond even what Matt and Rand do. And it shocks me almost that he's just so blasé about all these things and determined not to think about them. He bats away the thought of this man being consumed from the inside by beetles, just exactly the way he bats away the colors that form in his head so that he can see Matt and Rand. And it's just, that's almost as creepy to me as the scarabs and the beetles things. And yes, I have those same images from movies that I've seen. It was like, ew, that is just so creepy.
I also, for some reason, and I can't put my mind or my finger on it to date, I never really liked the lady who was in charge of the four group distribution. She was just always kind of one of those characters that I was like, man, if I were there, it would be hard for me, you know, unless I were possibly a Shanshan who had been serving at a lower level than this person my entire life, not to just outright hit her in the face.
Yeah, I agree, but clearly we're meant to dislike this character from the first. I love the way she says, I don't doubt that I may be offered a new name after this because of my good work with the Forkroot, but then again, I may not accept. Like, oh my god, how arrogant and conceited could you possibly be?
I do think it's a measure of adaptability that Tylee isn't completely, I mean, she might be shocked by it, but she's not put off in the slightest, really, by Perrin's accepting of not only accepting healing, but accepting healing from a man who can channel. I mean, that seems, you know, it seems really interesting that she's like, you'd let him use the one power on you? And Perrin's like, yeah, why not? She's like, oh, well, yeah. Ooh,
I know. She doesn't really know quite what to make of Perrin, but she's just assumed that he's something, I guess, above and beyond, because she makes a comment earlier about Perrin, you know, the hammer, your eyes, you know, this, that, the next thing. Who are you? Little does she know.
Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, I know Balwer has been with the children for so long. I find it really interesting at how interested he seems to be in who's king now. And, you know, as near as I can tell, there might not be a king in this country, or in Amadisia now, just because the Shanshan found him thoroughly wanting, and it might just be that one of the blood is kind of in command, and no one's really appointed a new quote-unquote king.
That could be. I just wanted to go back one second. When Tylee says that about Perrin, it really reminded me strongly of Min's first reaction to Rand when they're talking about everything in the stable when they're getting ready to run for the first time that they're all together, and she says, you know, who are you, Sheepherder, the dragon reborn? And Tylee, I hear in my mind almost the same sort of questioning, you know, this is definitely somebody, you know, beyond what we're used to.
Yeah, that is true. And I'm trying to remember, is there a moment where Fael does almost the same thing with Perrin at one point when they first meet, or is that... I'm trying to remember. I know she has an exclamation in The Dragon Reborn when Perrin goes and he works at the forge and that, and he comes away from it and she's sitting there watching him and she's like, you know, you really are a blacksmith. And he's like, yeah, I am.
You know, actually, I misspoke. That was actually Fael who said that to Perrin when they got ready to run. It wasn't Min. When Moraine first agrees to let Fael go with them, and then she turns around and she goes, who are you, Sheepherd of the, or something like that, or who are you, Blacksmith, the Dragon Reborn? I think I got that mixed up, actually. But yes, there is a similar thing in the, oh, you really are a blacksmith, absolutely. And then the smith says that, you know, and yes, he certainly is, and what he's done today amounts to his masterpiece as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, but Perrin will never accept it because his master is, you know, still in Emmon's field, although, you know, rather prominent, and you know, he will never actually go back and actually do anything because they made him a lord, and he's like, I'm a lord.
I know, I never saw three guys dragged kicking and screaming into the nobility, riches, and fame, and fortune as these three kids, considering that was ostensibly the reason they were all rather excited to leave Emmon's Field at some point in time before all this actually happened. I guess fantasizing about it is a little different than actually being dragged off by an Aes Sedai.
I kind of also, in this chapter, liked that Perrin has the moment where he reminds the readers, oh yeah, that's right, Moraine had the Horn of Valyr taken to the White Tower. This is just to remind you where it is.
Or is it?
Yeah, I could definitely see this being a total misdirection, because all evidence points that it's in the White Tower, but, you know, we never can really be sure of that.
No, the only thing we know is that Moraine and Siwan put it somewhere that they thought was safe, and I have to say that the original podcast crew, of which I believe you were a part at that point, I think they nailed it when they said that that's where Varen went, to go get the Horn of Valyr and bring it back to Matt. I definitely subscribe to that theory myself.
All right. Do you have any other thoughts on Chapter 12?
No, other than the thought that I have to say that this is one of my favorite chapters in a lot of ways. It reveals a lot of different sides of Perrin, and I actually think that Tylee Kerghan is one of my favorite minor characters. She just appealed to me from almost the beginning. She's just no nonsense, you know, straight shooter, and I really like her. Her personality seems to really appeal to me.
Yeah, I also like Tylee, and as far as what you said about Perrin, yeah, it's actually nice because you see every stage of his plan, from like when they start it to as they begin to implement it, and you know, and how, you know, he works past little things like them kind of, oh, we have to have the correct number of people as a proper escort, and you know, who balances out who and everything, but then just the, you know, how you go about getting the things that'll carry the fork root, how you get the, you know, fork root itself, and, you know, just all of the pieces of the plan coming together is just really nice.
Actually, I really think that Balwer kind of nailed it about Perrin, that he may not be devious, he may not be cunning and everything, but he's quite effective and quite intelligent and able to come up with these rather complex and really ingenious plans. I mean, he's constantly deriding himself for being a little bit slow of wit, you know, that it takes him a long time to get anywhere, but I don't see that he's that much slower than anybody else, and he really arrives at a lot of good conclusions, some bad ones. But this was a really, really good plan, and he put it into effect really well, and I think it shows another side of him beyond just the Taviran having the effect of making people want to follow them, whether they would have normally or not. It shows that he has a lot of native intelligence and ability beyond just, you know, Taviran drawing what they need to them even before they know they need it.
Yeah, definitely. And Perrin has that sense of someone who, because of his tendency to really think things through, really comes off as being someone who should be in charge of things. I mean, it just, yeah, the way he naturally thinks lends itself towards, if not like battle command, at least general command within the world.
That's true, and actually he has a lot of personality characteristics in common with his father-in-law, Davron Brashear. You know, he's pretty much unflappable, and actually Gareth Bryn, too, now that I think about it. You know, he nothing bothers him. He doesn't panic. He doesn't get mad. He doesn't scream and yell. He doesn't throw hissy fits. He just does what he needs to do. He tells people what they need to do, and he moves on. And, you know, that's really a lot of being a leader, is just being able to instill confidence in your people just by your way of dealing with things. And he's definitely got that, even more than, in some respects, even more than Matt.
So that pretty much wraps up Chapter 12. From here, we leave Perrin and move to Camelin for Chapter 13, The Siege. Elaine, along with Avienda, the Queen's Guard, led by Lieutenant Cassil, and four of the kin, including Elise, Caden, and Kumika, are on the walls inspecting things as Brigitte leads the defense of the walls, while Armilla's men are attacking. Whenever an attack begins, the kin make a gateway to bring the soldiers to the point of the attack. Elaine thinks that the siege hasn't given her time to mourn for Morghese and Linny, whom she believes dead at the hands of Raven. When Armilla's force begins to withdraw, Elaine rides forward to the wall and climbs to the top of the tower near Brigitte. Avienda and the Queen's Guard follow. Elaine believes she is not reborn healthy. Brigitte orders the mercenaries to pursue and kill the fleeing attackers, but they do not readily respond. Their captain, Rhys Abalamon, says that he knows Alden Mihiris, who was heading the attacking force, and explains that the mercenaries aren't going to pursue retreating foes because their positions could be reversed in the next battle, and they want to kind of keep a civil discord between mercenary forces. Mistress Harfour has learned that someone is trying to bribe the mercenaries away from her. Elaine wishes she knew how Matt, Tom, and Oliver are doing. She wishes she had Gareth Bryne with her as well, but she knows that Egwene needs him more in the Siege of Tarfalon. A huge thunderstorm appears out of nowhere, directly above the inner city, which blocks the view of the royal palace. Avienda disperses it by weaving air, fire, and water and earth. Soon it is just an ordinary rain. The kinswomen open a gate back to the main stable yard, and everyone rides through. Several of the kin have run away recently. Elaine thinks that Nynaeve put far too much backbone into them, and that is the reason for their disappearances. In the stable yard, another gateway is open, and the Queen's Guard ride through, led by Lieutenant Charles Guybon. Captain Kindlin in Arengal let him come to Camelin after Nain and the others escaped. He recruited men discharged by Gabriel and other loyal armsmen along the way, and their force totals nearly 10,000. Mistress Zagain of the kin found them and brought them to Elaine by gateway. Elaine is amazingly delighted by this turn of events and promotes Charles Guybon to captain. Brigitte makes him her second in command, and they all go inside to try to dry off.
Okay, well, I have to start off by saying that I'm very prejudiced. This section is probably one of my least favorite in the entire books. I don't know why. I just want to skip over it. And other than the introduction of Charles Guybon, I don't see a lot in here that's particularly anything but just, you know, narrative. And, well, and I should say also the disappearing kinswoman. Those are probably, to me, the two high points of that chapter, and something that, you know, will portend in the future. Otherwise, it seems to be kind of just not really fluff, but narrative.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, there really isn't a great deal of import in most of this chapter. The random storm showing up and Avienda kind of getting rid of it sort of only points out that Elaine right now is really bad with the One Power because of her pregnancy. You know, the entire thing with her taking insane risks because she knows her babies will be born healthy is sheer stupidity on Elaine's part. And with the exception of, yeah, maybe the mercenaries, which just that entire kind of, oh, well, you know, who knows, the next battle, I might be retreating, and they would have a chance to pursue me, and if I let them go this time, they'll might let me go next time, kind of thing, is like, oh, well, that's nice and all wonderful that you have, you know, honor among thieves. But yeah, by and large, the arrival of Gaiman and his men, and yeah, the disappearing kinswomen are definitely the very major portions of this particular chapter, possibly with the exception of Birgit making Gaiman her second in command, because we all know, of course, that Captain Mellar is really, you know, a dark friend, and he's, you know, has ill intent for Elaine in the future. But at this point, they don't really have any real reason why he shouldn't be promoted or why he shouldn't be Birgit's second. So, I mean, there's a little bit of politics in there, but it's not really in the foreground at all.
Yeah, I have to agree. I completely agree with you about the Elaine taking insane risks comment. That is totally sheer stupidity, and it's probably one of the reasons that these chapters tend to irritate me so much. I think she's better than that. I don't understand this blind stupidity that she goes on and on about, but every character has to have their weaknesses and blind spots. The other things that I see about this chapter are that they basically are sort of bringing back a lot of other threads to the forefront of our attention. You know, she thinks about Tom and Oliver, you know, she thinks about Gareth Brynes and Egwene, and so, you know, we're basically getting a little reminder that, yes, there are other characters, they're coming up again, and just wait for it.
Oh yeah, it's definitely interesting, because probably about, well, around this point, we have to assume that, you know, as Elaine is thinking about, you know, Egwene and, you know, Gareth Brynes needing her at Tar Valon, at this point, you know, they're frantically trying to figure out what to do, because Egwene's been captured. So it is one of those interesting things that kind of reinforces that, once again, the good guys, not so great on the communication skills.
Yeah. And again, as we mentioned, the only other significant revelation is the disappearance of some of the kinswomen that they believe have run away, and then, of course, we find out later that they have been done away with. Okay, the next chapter is another chapter from Elaine's point of view, entitled Wet Things. And the chapter opens with Elaine, Birgitta, Avienda, and the guardswoman walking through the royal palace. There are many new servants in the royal palace, since so many left while Gabriel reigned and when Rand took Caemlyn. They run into Rhianna Corley with Cara Defonnet and Jellari, the former Domani. Jellari and Marilla still cannot be trusted with Suldam. Neither can Cara or L'Amour, though they are not Seanchan themselves. Rhianna tells them that Marley Noichin admitted to seeing weaves. There are 28 more to go, but now Marley insists that she must be collared. Elaine wants to send Broken Suldam back to the Seanchan to break their power. Van Deen and Jaim pass a crossing corridor with Kirstian and Zarya following. Rhianna can hardly wait to go to the White Tower. She wants to be Green Aja. Yay, greens! And Van Deen is still obsessed with Adelais's death and now wears her clothing almost exclusively. Renee Harfour approaches with news that three of the mercenary captains are in the blue reception room, having demanded an audience with Elaine. Dwellin, Millar, Carian, and Saritha are with them. Elaine does not trust Millar anymore, and one of Marilla, Carianna, and Saritha is definitely Black Aja. Dialin has not yet returned. They continue toward Elaine's quarters and then run into Chanel, Din Saran, White Shark, and Renala Din Kalon. They still wear mourning stoles for Nesta. They want to know about Talon and Marilella, who have gone missing. Elaine testily replies that every inn has been searched, so they must have left Caemlyn. If the Windfinders do not return to their duties bringing in stores, they will be breaking Zyda's bargain. Chanel orders Renala to go to the Silver Swan herself and recruit some of the sisters there. There are 9 sisters there at present. They would not tell Saritha and carry on anything. Chanel leaves to travel to Tyr. Once again, Elaine heads for her apartments to dry off.
Yeah, another really short chapter and pretty straightforward one. It's really interesting, and Encyclopedia Watt brings this up a number of times in their summaries of the chapters. Elaine and her new distrust of Mellar seems really sudden and quite unexplained. It's a weird thing, because it mentions the previous time that we saw Elaine and her interactions with Melar. She pretty much thought he was a sleazeball, but she didn't have any distrust for him past the point of, well, I just don't really like him. And in this chapter and the couple upcoming, she has some thoughts within her point of view that lead to more certainty that he's an absolute villain and he can't be trusted and he has to be followed. And it's weird because there doesn't seem to be any real basis for why she feels that way or how she's learned things about him that she did learn.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact dislike of him turned to distrust as well. I think there was an event that tipped her off, but honestly, I can't bring it to mind at the moment. Again, I really feel like this is another chapter that is basically just reminding us of some of the various different characters and plot lines that are going on that we haven't seen for a while.
The other thing that I really noted was the entire Chanel and Renéal. And just, again, you get those kind of, the sea folk show up and, you know, they want what they want. And Elaine just kind of firmly is like, look, you're breaking your bargain if you don't go and do what you're supposed to do. You know, I've done everything I can to find these, you know, Talon and Merilil, but, you know, at this point, you're being lax in your duties, so shut up and put out.
Yeah, that was kind of great. That's one of the few times when Elaine has really gotten the better of the sea folk, and she seems to be starting to get a handle on how to manage them a little bit.
I'm trying to remember, Talon and Merilil, were they the ones who actually went off to the White Tower?
We don't actually know where they went, but we know that Talon wanted to go to the White Tower. She was really anxious to become a novice, and we presume that Merilila took her to the tower, but we don't really know. They just disappeared. In fact, we don't know absolutely, positively, if Talon went with Merilila, but there was mention of some woman with tattooed hands and another woman heavily cloaked leaving the gates of the city together, but we don't really know for sure. We just assume.
It was one of those things that was kind of nagging in my mind because it wasn't something that I paid enough attention to in my last reread, and it was like, I vaguely remember them having gone, but I don't remember if I was remembering it correctly or not, so.
Well, one thing that just kind of sprang to my mind is that, why is it that the kin are being killed and disappearing, but nobody's bumping off the sea folk?
I don't really know. Presumably, the kin are all staying together. The initial thought would be, well, the sea folk are such a tight-knit group that maybe they're all just sticking directly together. But now that I'm thinking about it, the kin would have no reason to be any more distant with each other than the sea folk are. The only other thing I could think is if the person in question is either a member of the kin or a member of the sea folk. And in which case, the reason it's not happening is either because it's a dark friend within the ranks, or it's, you know, one of the sea folk dark friends who's trying to drive away some extra level of danger to their exposure.
I never actually assumed that it was one of either of those two groups that was doing it. For some reason, I had it in my mind that it was Shane, Alvaran, but I could be
wrong. That's true. I don't remember clearly, but for some reason I'm thinking that it comes out later that the women were killed with the One Power, which immediately makes me think Black Aja, because a lot of the Elaine chapters are focused on finding out who's Black Aja amongst the Aes Sedai. But, you know, now I've, of course, you know, voiced the idea that there might actually be a traitor in the mist, so I don't know.
You know, just to try and drive away, and any possible supporters that can channel, that they can pry away from Elaine's side, would certainly be a benefit, causing chaos, if nothing else, but obviously in the long run, you know, fewer allies for her. But we're really, and you know, were we ever told Nesta Denrias Bluestar, I think it was? They mentioned that she was killed in a previous chapter, and they're still wearing mourning stoles. Did we ever hear how she died?
Hold on a second.
I'm just wondering if that's significant. I mean, we have all these, you know, people getting killed. They are part of a further plot. And I really do think it would be just hysterical if some of the Athaan mayor turned out to be Athaan Shador.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think we know from the Dark Friend social that there is at least one Seafolk Dark Friend amongst the many characters in the book.
Oh, I know, but when we read that originally, you know, we didn't know that the Shandan called Dark Friends off of Han Shador, and I just think it's funny that, you know, it's like good or something, I don't know.
Ah, Nesta is executed by the Shanshan when they take Ebudar.
Blades, too, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think their heads decorate some sort of, you know, oh, look, we've tarred their heads and stuck them on poles on top of the city walls so that everybody knows what they did.
With a sign saying traitors and rebellion or something like that.
The other thing of note in this chapter was Marley seems to take quite a bit to break one of the Soldam and get them to admit. And I kind of credit Elaine that, oh, well, you know, the best thing to do is just... But at the same time, it's kind of like... I note that, why did Rand even bother sending me these women? And it's like, they're women who can channel, and he couldn't keep them around himself. What else is he going to do with them? It seems like, oh, look, there's 28 more to go. Out of the 29 Soldam that were sent to us, we only have 28 more. And I'm like, yes, but how long did it take you to get that one of the 29 to admit that, yes, she can see?
Rand has a real knack for that. I don't think... That was probably one of the most unwelcome presents he could have sent to Elaine, unless they somehow turn out to be significant for Elaine in the last battle. I just can't imagine what possible purpose they could serve other than to just continue ramping up the level of irritation that she seems to be experiencing all the time.
Yeah, definitely. We continue Elaine's point of view in Chapter 15, A Different Skill. Elaine and Avienda get lost on their way to Elaine's apartments because some of the palace corridors are different. Brigitte goes to her own rooms, sometimes tugging on her braid, almost like Nynaeve. Dolan Mellar still commands the guardswomen, although most of them are loyal to Elaine and Brigitte. The guards worry about assassins and followers of Lyda. In her apartments, Isande, Sefany, and Nerys await. Nerys goes for food while Isande and Sefany help Avienda and Elaine change. Avienda, of course, has plenty of dresses, which were gifts from Tillin. When her pregnancy bothers Elaine, she sometimes regrets not drinking the heartleaf tea before laying with Rand. Avienda toys with a dull dagger to Rangriel. She thinks that it prevents the shadow from seeing the possessor, not the eyeless, nor the shadow twisted, maybe not even leaf blighter. Avienda cannot make Tarangriel, but at this point Elaine realizes that she has a different talent, that of identifying Tarangriel. They hurry to the sitting room where Elaine keeps the other Tarangriel from Ebudar. Despite Min's viewings of her baby's safety, Elaine can no longer study the Tarangriel because of her poor grasp on the one power that is an effect of pregnancy. The Tarangriel are safe there, as Rene Harfour has eliminated most of the dishonest servants. Avienda examines the other articles in the room. The flexible black rod causes a controllable level of pain. The metal helmet controls some sort of machine. The ivory box holds music, hundreds and hundreds of tunes. A flattish white bull, almost a pace across, is for looking at things that are far away. A tall vase gathers water out of the air. A black and white figurine of a bird with long wings spread in flight is for talking to people a long way off, as is a blue figure of a woman, numerous rings, earrings, and bracelets. A dull black rod is for cutting metal or stone. A glass figure of a man will chase away vermin. A root-like carving is for growing something that is like holes. It is activated by singing. A 2-foot statue holds thousands and thousands of books. Avienda channels fire and earth into the smiling man, and the words in the old tongue appear, Ansonen and Imsoen, lies and truth, or fiction and non-fiction. Nadere and Dorinda enter. They have come for Avienda. The clan is leaving on the orders of the Karakarn. Avienda hurriedly leaves to change clothing and pack. Nerys arrives with food, inspecting the meal. Nadere wants to know who is taking care of Elaine. Monale is Melanie's midwife. Nisande offers that her niece, Melfane, is a midwife. Elaine wants, of course, to choke Rand, but all she knows of him is that he is somewhere far to the southeast. Avienda returns in Aiel garb with a packed bundle and gives Elaine the dull dagger. Elaine gives Avienda an amber turtle Ongreal and the twisted ring Tarongreal. She still has the seated woman and the silver ring, which both require the channeling of spirit to enter Teleronriad. Avienda, Durinda, and Nadere leave. Elaine goes to meet with the mercenaries. One of the interesting things, and we pointed this out, concerning the shifting of the walls, I think we pointed this out in the last podcast, was that, you know, someone theorizes, you know, what happens if you happen to be, like, wake up in your room and suddenly there are no doors, or what happens if you're in a hallway when it disappears? And a lot of people are kind of now leaning towards the idea that this is an effect of the Dark One's touch and not an effect of the use of Balefire on the pattern or just any other sort of supernatural thing, but that it might actually be purposeful. I don't necessarily know that I've completely come down on one side or another, but it is one of those interesting kind of theories, just, you know, what does happen to the areas of the palace that now no longer exist. The only other thing that in my mind was weird was that the only thing that we really see occurring in Camelin that we didn't see anywhere else was the use of Balefire in Teleronriad, and we know that things in Teleronriad aren't supposed to affect things in the waking world, but I'm not certain, because for some reason I seem to remember afterwards the mutability of Teleronriad in the royal palace was altered somewhat. Like, you get the idea, like, you know, oh, you Balefire-fired the column, and that it would still kind of be there, but it would, like, flicker in this odd way, like it was trying to resist coming back to the way it's supposed to be. And I'm not now wondering if maybe, and this is probably under crazy and dismissible theories, if maybe that might not have had some sort of effect. Or, you know, if it is just like other people think, you know, the Dark One messing with things because he can touch the world so much more now, or any of the other myriad reasons for it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's got to be the Dark One messing with things. I don't understand how using so much Balefire in Camelin would, or anywhere, didn't necessarily affect that. Yeah, I don't know. I'm surprised that with these corridors shifting around randomly the way they are, that nobody has gone missing that way. And at first I sort of thought maybe that was what happened to some of the kinswomen, but why just them? So it's hard. It's hard to know. I think it's just part of the desolation, the aura of dissolution that's about the world at this point in time because of the Dark One breaking free. And I wonder how Rand's going to fix that, other than defeating the Dark One.
Yeah, definitely. I also kind of like the dagger, like the weird dull dagger Tarongreal. And, you know, preventing shadow spawn of pretty much every type from being able to see its bearer. And I'm not now wondering if Min's viewing, which said that the babies would be born, doesn't come from the fact that Avienda made that gift to Elaine. And that maybe the reason that she survives while taking these insane risks, because, you know, she's got this protection that keeps that protects creatures of the Dark One from being able to notice that she's even there.
Yeah, some of those Tarongreal really were very interesting, and I think it's remarkable that just when they need this protection the most, they discover the use of this particular Tarongreal. But then that sort of seems to be the way it is. I know that none of the other major characters are supposed to be Tavirin, but they do seem to have some of the same ability to find what they need before they even know they need it.
True. I mean, I also like that we got no indication prior to this chapter that there was even a talent for discovering what Terangreal do. You know, and then it's like, suddenly it was like, you know what? Aviand is a cool character, but she needs to be just a little cooler. How could we make her a little cooler? I know. We'll have her be able to identify any Terangreal that she handles. Oh, okay. Cool.
I know. Well, I sort of felt that one of the reasons that he did that was because, you know, Elaine was basically the queen of Terangreal. She made them before anybody else. She knew more about them than anybody else. She'd studied them more than anybody now living. And then he incapacitated her ability to do that because she got pregnant. And he made it so that she didn't want to take the risk, A, because she could burn herself out or kill herself or who knows what doing the studying, but then also he made it so that she had a hard time holding on to Sidar and manipulating Weaves while she was pregnant. So he basically eliminated her from the ability to tell what they were for. So now they've got all these Terangreals sitting around. Nobody knows what to do with. Well, we better figure out some way to figure out how to use them. So, hey, Avienda got a new talent. Woohoo!
Yeah, there was also, and we've mentioned this particular Terangreal both in the Objects of the One Power episodes and in a number of other episodes, the root-like carving. Yay, we finally see a talisman of growing.
I know, I thought that was completely cool, and it was obvious immediately, I think, to everybody. But you know, I really was upset that they didn't spend a little bit more time on that little man statue with the books, you know, fiction and nonfiction and so forth and so on. Because to me, gosh, you guys are going into the toughest time, you know, in this last age. And here's a fountain of information from the age before, from the Age of Legends, where all the Aes Sedai were very powerful. You know, the place where the Forsaken learned everything that they know. Hello? How much trouble could you get into studying a book, Terangreal? Look at all the knowledge in there that they could come up with, and they could figure out how to do things that they've forgotten, how to defeat the Dark One. I'm telling you, why didn't they spend some time looking into that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, and then there were some of these Terangreal that didn't seem, you know, amazingly like, okay, we've got 130 cell phones. And yeah. We got the glass guy who can chase away rats.
I know. It's like, if they're for talking to somebody over a distance, why don't you just open a gateway and take one to Nynaeve or Sarand or somebody so you can have a little chat with them? Oh, my goodness. Of course, then we're going to go into Jesse's favorite topic of what would the world of Randland be if they all had cell phones and text messaging.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at the very least, in that, open a really small gateway and just chuck one through at them.
Sort of like the Kleenex box through the Stargate.
Yeah, exactly.
Send more.
But, you know, there was the metal helmet, what controls some sort of machine, and I think we've pretty much exhausted the possibilities of what that might mean, whether it's like something for, you know, construction equipment, or, you know, whether it, you know, is used in controlling like a Jokar or a Showing, or whether it's, you know, like we've gone through, I think, everything, you know, including, oh, it might be a helmet for a battle mech. And, you know, it's just like, unless it comes up in the next, you know, three books,
yeah,
that it seems like a kind of a pointless thing. The flattish white bull, that's interesting just because of the literary reference to a scrying. A scrying bowl, and that's about basically the only real thing that it can be compared to, is the sorcerers of old taking a large flat bowl and filling it with a small amount of water and being able to gaze either into the future or at, you know, things far away.
Yeah, I just really felt cheated that suddenly we've got Avienda getting this talent to read Terangreal, which I kind of thought Nynaeve had a little bit of as well. She has an ability anyway, if not an absolute talent, but I felt really robbed that we just found a way to figure out what all these bloody Terangreal are for, and she's going away. Okay, thanks very much.
Yeah, I understand. Although the clan isn't just disappearing, we do actually know where Bale's clan is going. Rand is sending Bale's clan into the Ara Dumon to try to restore order there. So it is a good thing when the Aiel then later show up in that area, we at least know where they went.
Yeah, well, why has Rand suddenly decided that everything's going to happen in Ara Dumon? I never really did quite figure out that leap of logic.
I really have no clue. But apparently it's in enough chaos that Rand wanted it stopped, and therefore the best way to do that is send in your elite strike unit. I mean, Aiel.
Apparently so. I mean, but he's sending everybody. He's sending Darlan. He's sending Loghain, and the Windfinders are going to bring supplies, and he's sending all the Aiel. Who else? We don't even know who else. Presumably, you know, Bashir and the Legion of the Dragon. I don't understand why Ara Dumon.
It might be just the idea that Ara Dumon has this vast amount of space, and I think if he sends everybody there, he might actually just be trying to use it as a staging ground to then, like, massively portal everyone to Shai'al Ghul.
Yeah, I suppose. Now, he must have something in mind, certainly. I think this is the point where he really needs, you know, Matt back with him, though, so that he can, you know, lend his expertise to planning all these battle strategies, although he does have Bashir along, so that's pretty much the next best thing. And as far as elite strike units and mobilization of armies, what's going on with all those Borderlanders? They're looking for Rand. Why doesn't somebody mention to Rand, hey, you know, we've got all these trained Borderland units who might be useful for you, dude, if you kind of go talk to them?
Yeah, but I mean, that's also partially, like, the Borderlanders were kind of going to Rand, if I remember properly, to kind of, like, slap him upside the head and say, dude, what are you doing?
Yeah, the fight's going to be in the Borderlands. What are you doing, dude?
I don't know.
Well, I guess if they need to, Elaine can gate them all back over there somewhere if they ever find out that they're wanted.
So, following Avienda's departure, we move on to Chapter 16, The New Follower. Elaine and Birgit go to meet with the mercenary leaders in the Blue Reception Room. Denny Colford leads a new contingent of guardswomen, having replaced Devor and her crew. Mistress Harfor is there with a couple of maids and Halwyn Nori, Karine, Saritha, and Dolan Mellar. Elaine no longer feels the need to protect Rand's babies, but she still allows the rumor to persist that they are in fact Mellars. She's now very sure that he's a villain, although, as we said previously, we really don't know why. Elaine sends Mellar away because she's clearly annoyed with him. Bakuvun acknowledges that he knew Mellar 2 years ago. The mercenaries wish that the Aes Sedai would leave. They've apparently been badgering the mercenaries about the power of the White Tower. The mercenaries have requested the audience because they have been losing men and they want more money. Elaine still needs them, even with the men that Gaiban brought with him. Even so, Elaine angrily refuses to give in. Saritha and Karine reminded the mercenaries that the White Tower will back Elaine over Armilla. Elaine has a hard time believing that one of them, or Merilil, is Black Aja. The mercenaries leave, and Elaine asks the Aes Sedai and guardswomen to leave also. She then weaves fire and air and a trace of water to place a ward against eavesdropping. Mistress Harfor then divulges a report from John Skellet. He was a spy for Nain Arwen. Armilla and the other High Seats plan to ride into Camelon soon. Elania and Nain have pledged to Armilla. Master Nori has found an accomplished cutpurse, which he wishes to use to try to follow Mellar. The first five have died. Guardsman Afrim Hansard enters, bringing in Samwell Hark. Hark claims that he has inherited his money from an aunt in Four Kings, and that he clerked recently for a deceased merchant, Wilbin Sames, but Nori has direct evidence that he is lying. Elaine makes an attempt at being as implacable a judge as Morghese is, and offers, instead of a hanging, a job which will be to tail Melar, and then, following that assignment, an exile to Bear-Lorne. Samwell accepts this offer, and Elaine weaves spirit and lays a finder on his clothing, and then sends him away. She's certain Melar was put in place to either spy on her or arrange her kidnapping, and she's determined to get to the person who is calling the shots and making Melar do what he's doing. She knows that he has faked the kidnap attempt that brought him to her attention in the first place. Denny Colford returns with news that Lady Dylan is back. When she is refreshed, Elaine will meet her in the map room. A couple of introductory notes. Encyclopedia Watt mentions twice in this particular chapter summary that the reasons for Elaine's sudden turn on Melar and how she managed to find out that he set up the fake kidnap attempt is really unclear. They do also point out that when the captain, Bakuvun, mentions that he knows Melar from 2 years ago, what he doesn't mention is that Melar isn't the man's real name. And it's just an interesting point that he doesn't point that out to Elaine at all. And the only other bit, which was very interesting amidst the notes, is that, and I didn't place this in my mind at all until just recently, the weave she uses and laying the finder on Samwell Hark's clothing is actually the same weave that Moraine uses in Eye of the World to place the finder on the coins that she gives the three boys.
Oh, I never thought about that. You're right. That's pretty cool. Yeah, it only works on metal. I think Hermione Granger had that same one, too. Well, she did. Okay, so, well, I suppose the bit about the mercenaries was basically foreshadowing of what happened later in the book, basically setting up the idea that the mercenaries were not to be trusted, which Brigida has always pretty much maintained, and so was Dylan.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I don't know if maybe Bakuvun not pointing out Melar's name might not be an indicator that Bakuvun himself might also be a dark friend. And, you know, pointing out that he knew Melar from a few years ago is one thing, but, you know, tactically leaving out information that, you know, why is he going under a different name? Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, it's a little shifty, and, you know, I don't know if it's anything that you could make a solid case out of, but, you know, there might be something to keep an eye on in upcoming chapters as we see Bakuvun again.
Yeah, I confess I don't really have too much else to add on that particular chapter.
There was an interesting thing. Honestly, if you were Melar, don't you think you might try to be a little more conspicuous if you've had to kill 5 people that were obviously following you? I mean, you know, at some point, wouldn't you turn around and go, or maybe I should try to being a little more careful with what I'm doing if I don't want people to notice what I'm doing.
Yeah. That kind of struck me as odd, too. Well, he's so arrogant that nothing really surprises me with that guy.
I mean, I definitely also like that in this chapter, Elaine kind of puts on that, you know, well, these are the various punishments that you could be given for the various things that you do, and, you know, obviously I probably should just hang you, but, you know, just that kind of judicial way she kind of works Samwell around to agreeing, oh, no, definitely, I'll do this job for you, and then I'll accept a nice, comfortable exile in Bear-Lorne. Definitely, Your Majesty.
Yeah, that was kind of weird. I guess he's figuring that he'll get out of it at the last minute somehow.
If I remember properly, Elaine does also point out, it's like, you know, I'm Aes Sedai, right? You know, they kind of direct intimidation factor of, you know, if you think you're going to escape the deal you make with me, well, you better think again.
Exactly. Yeah, she's getting very regal, for sure.
Yeah, well, and she's also getting very Aes Sedai, because I remember she tells him that she's placing a weave on his clothing, and he's, like, you know, looking at it all nervous, like, oh my god, you know, what's happening? So, moving right along, we'll conclude this particular episode with Chapter 17, A Bronze Bear. Elaine leaves Mistress Harfour and Master Nori and heads for the map room, accompanied by Birgitte, Denny, and the other guardswomen. The royal palace is apparently packed to the gills. Many minor nobles are in the palace, having brought along a few armsmen to aid Elaine. On her way, she passes words with some of them. Elaine also visits with Abram Pensenor. He first brought news that Aramilla, Nain, and Elenia were the ones marching on Camelin. House Pensenor has been allied to House Taravin for generations. The nobles have heard the news of Gyvan, but they are now nervous because of the changes to the structure of the palace. That is why Renee Harfour and Nerys are nervous as well. Denny, for some reason, remains stoic. She recalls that she was more afraid of Eldrin Hackley when he nearly killed her, because that danger, at least, was real. Birgitte is somewhat morose. She confides that her earliest memories are now the four lives that she led between the founding of the White Tower and the end of the Trolloc Wars, and even they are fading. She fears that she is going to eventually forget Gydel Cain entirely. They arrive in the map room. The map of Camelin that covers most of this floor predates Andor and even Arthur Hogwing, but it is frequently updated to keep up with modern changes. Because of the great map, Birgitte uses this room very often as her office. A clerk, Mistress Andfor, brings Elaine a report, but Birgitte sends her and the other clerks out. There is a current map of Camelin and the surrounding area of Andor on a table. It notes that the Black Tower is 2 leagues south of the city. Pins and markers show Armilla's 8 different camps, the Goshen camp and Dovran Bashir's camp. Elaine tells Birgitte to check on the Saldian camp and the Black Tower to see if any of them have left with the Goshen. They wonder where Rand has sent the Goshen. A bronze bear 50 miles northeast marks the borderlanders. Elaine has hoped that their presence would deter Aramilla, Luan, Ellarine, and Abel. Aemlyn, Arathanel, and Pelavar have 60,000 men in their 2 camps south of the Black Tower. Dailan has begun negotiating with them. Dailan arrives a short time later. She is also disturbed by the palace changing. 4 of the young high seats also follow her in. Caitlin has to share a bed with Dailan and Sir Gaze because the palace is now so crowded. They want to know what Dailan learned, and Elaine wonders how they knew of her mission in the first place. Or so far, the 6 high seats will not take sides. Aemlyn, Arathel, and Pelavar want Dailan for the throne. Luan and Abel are noncommittal. Luan and Pelavar helped arrest Nain and Elenia, but that does not sway them now. Ellarine is still furious because Morghese had her flogged under Ravin's influence. Dailan left Karalael Sertovni and Julania Fote to watch them. 3 of the kin are also watching the Borderlanders. That leaves 6 houses for Elaine, 6 for Armilla, 6 neutral, and 1, the Candrade, undecided. House Montiar preceded Trachond in holding the throne in the first place, and Norwalin preceded Montiar. That evening, Elaine reads in her sitting room. Stephanie is in attendance, and Urith heads the guards who are outside her door. Vandine enters with Kirsten and Zarya. Vandine asks permission to weave a ward against eavesdropping. Then she tells Elaine that Rianne Corley was murdered. Daris found a doll that belonged to Muraine, one of the supposed runaways, saying that she has treasured the doll so much that she was probably murdered rather than having run away and left it behind. It seems likely that the other kin who have disappeared were also murdered. Elaine thinks that the murderer is trying to frighten the kinswomen into fleeing. This means that Merilil is not the murderer. Elaine wonders why the Black Aja would prefer Armilla on the throne rather than her. Elaine asks Vandine to speak with Sumiko and Elise about calming the kin. She also wants to warn Chanel and the other Windfinders. From here, the point of view shifts to Armilla. Armilla is dining with Nain, Elenia, Nason, Sylvais, Lear, and Karind. Lear and Karind want to press an all-out attack on Camelin. Armilla wants to save her troops in order to fight the Borderlanders, should they decide to move against her. The support for Armilla notwithstanding, she also fears that some of the troops from her allies could possibly just decide to refuse to fight at all. Or all of their food is apparently spoiling. Sylvace questions the value of attacking Camelin if Luan and the others will not support their cause. Luan wants a truce so Andor can deal with the Borderlander army. Armilla thinks that Elarine and possibly Aemelin, Arathel, and Pelivar will side with her in the end. She plans for Elaine and Dailan to die. She thinks that she can coerce Conail and the other three children high seats to publish support for her. If she cannot, then Jacques Lonald can. A servant bearing Marn's four silver moons enters with a message from Master Jacob Hernville, Armilla's secretary. Outside, he reports that, quote-unquote, they have agreed, but they want all the gold up front. She orders him to draw up a letter to Mistress Onscale for her to sign. She orders him to tell them, quote, a week from today. In a week, she thinks the throne will be hers. She goes back inside to tell the others the good news. One of the interesting things here is that both of them are dealing with the other major houses that haven't taken sides yet. And it's interesting to see where Elaine and Dailan are fairly realistic. They're like, okay, these people are probably going to support us. These others are all really undecided, and you know, we're working on getting their support, but we're not going to say that they are. And Armilla's like, oh, I can get these people and these people and these people, and they'll definitely follow me, and it'll all be good. It is nice to see that Elaine's ploy with having the Borderlanders camped and looming is actually working against Armilla's forces and the other high seats as well. You know, it's causing just enough of a tension that, you know, people don't just outright side with Armilla against Elaine because of the things that Morghese did under Raven's influence. For some reason, Armilla's another one of them characters I just really would like to slap, because it seems like she has no forethought going into this on, you know, oh, her claim to the throne, if I remember properly, isn't all that good. And she has this, like, we're going to go about the sneakiest tactics we can possibly do. You know, we're going to try to bribe her mercenaries away from her, which, you know, Elaine already knows about and is trying to counter herself. And, you know, just the sheer audacity of, like, oh, I'm definitely going to have the throne within a week. Really? And what clues do you have to this? Seriously.
Massive overconfidence?
Yeah, I find it really interesting. I don't know if we actually noticed this before, but the Black Tower's really not that far from Camelin at all. I mean, 2 leagues south of the city.
Yeah, that's a suburb, and I don't know what she's going to do about it, and I don't see how it's going to change. If anything, it will probably grow and get larger. It's really got to be a sore point with her. I think that, you know, with the last battle coming, especially, the Black Tower's got to be a real source of concern, because it seems like it could be very likely to be, you know, the focal point for some large battle with the One Power, which, as everybody seems to know, is likely to destroy everything for leagues around, which would be Camelin.
Yeah, that would really not be great.
No, and that's one of those things where, one of those situations where I think Rand really wasn't thinking ahead that far when he set up the Black Tower. In fact, I really felt like his whole creation of the Black Tower and then basically abandoning them to Mazrim Taim and his own resources was just really one of the poorest moves that Rand could have made. I mean, it was absolutely setting himself up for a huge problem in the future, and landing it all in Elaine's backyard as well isn't going to probably help him much either.
No, and in reflection, Elaine complains rather bitterly about the fact that, oh, thank you, Rand, you just dumped, you know, a cancerous tumor in the middle of my kingdom.
Yeah, pretty much.
I was a little saddened that one of the kinswomen to die was Rhian Corley.
Yeah, I was sorry to see her go, too. Well, I was complaining that RJ really doesn't kill off very many characters, and then when he does, they tend to be ones that we really would prefer that they hung around a little bit, you know?
I mean, she wasn't crucial or anything, which is, you know, of course, one of the easiest ways to make a character expendable. But and at the same time, you know, she was one of those ones that when you met her, she was immediately likable to the point that, you know, she was capable, she knew what was going on, she was, you know, kind of her own leader in her own right. And, you know, now with her being gone, the kin are diminished in a noticeable way.
Yeah, she was a very likable character, and they are really basically left leaderless in a way, because there no longer is an eldest, because that's a function basically of Ebedar. And Sumiko is, you know, high up in the rankings, but she doesn't want to be in charge of anything. And Elise really would do really well, but can't, according to the rules of the kin. So Rian's loss is a real, you know, blow to the organization of the kin. She, like you say, she was a likable character, and she wanted to be green. I mean, you know, how sad is that? She wanted to be green, now she won't.
Well, you know, in another age.
Yeah, if not in this life, then in another, I guess.
The other big thing that in my mind that I really noticed was the fading of Birgit. And I'm trying to determine if the pattern is trying to compensate for the fact that Birgit wasn't born, or, you know, and therefore she's becoming more like a woman who would have grown up having never known her previous selves, or if it's one of those weird things that because she wasn't spun out this time, because she was ripped into reality, if when things do finally fade, if she'll cease to actually be Birgit, or if worse over, if she kind of just dies or fades completely away in, you know, some way.
I don't think Brigida's fading so much as just her memories are fading. I don't remember anything about her fading herself. Did I miss something?
No, that was more metaphorical, in my opinion. I mean, it's just the idea that as her memories go, you know, it begs that question, well, why are they going? And what significance does it have when you finally do lose all of your memories? You know, you'd be like, oh, okay, well, I'm Birgit. That's wonderful. I remember from, 3 months ago.
Well, she's forgetting all the memories of her past lives. I don't think she's forgetting 3 months ago. Of course, she really hasn't got anything but her past lives except for what happened in the recent future, because, as you say, she wasn't born. Yeah, if she loses all her past lives, what is she going to do? Would she be able to function at all?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the point I'm getting at. I mean, we don't really know, but I imagine because it is being mentioned that it's going to come into play at some point in time.
I hadn't really thought about the long-term ramifications of her losing all of her past life memories and not having any but the most recent memories since she was ripped out of Telrunrod. I just really hadn't considered that, but yeah, how is she going to function as a normal human being with basically only the last memories of the last 6 months or something? Creepy, too.
Yeah. I do find it interesting that Elaine wants to send out people to check on both the Black Tower and Dovrum's camp to see if, you know, possibly because Rand sent the Goshin away, you know, well, maybe he'll send, you know, the Ashaman or Dovrum's camp away, too.
Yeah, you might send Dovrum's camp away, but it looks like the Ashaman are dug in for the duration there. But, I mean, there is the question at this point in time, if Rand ordered Mazrim Taim to, you know, pick up and move to, say, Ardoman with all the other people he's sitting there, would Taim even do it?
Well, I mean, if he sent that order, would he bother to check up and make sure Taim's done it?
I don't know. Rand seems to have a lot of other stuff on his plate. It doesn't seem like checking up on the Black Tower at all is even on his radar. He's pretty much obdurate about just letting them go their own way. I mean, he sort of says, I'll deal with that later, and he's worried about dealing with everything else first. I think if that were me, that would be pretty high on my list of priorities, a whole hassle of possibly rogue channelers running around, not obeying your orders anymore. That would make me a little uneasy.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, Rand should have had more interaction here from the Black Tower to begin with. Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of interesting that, he sets it up, and then he comes back, what, once, maybe twice, and then just doesn't think to check on them ever again. And it's like, hi, these are people I would probably think to try to keep around me all the time, and have them constantly under my watchful gaze so that, you know, they constantly know that I am the one who's in charge here, and, you know, Rand just didn't do that.
No, and Loghain even tells him, you know, that the men at the Black Tower know Mazrim Taim. They don't know you. They've never seen you, most of them. Only the very beginning guys and the ones that he, you know, picked up from the aftermath of Dumai's Wells, those are the only ones that have even ever seen Rand in person, as far as we know. He's been there, as you said, just a couple of times, and then a couple of times Mazrim Taim and you know, a few of the other Ashaman from the Black Tower have come to give him messages or something like that, but that's it. It's like, somebody on one of the theory posts pointed out that looked like Dreadlord Central coming up to them, and I have to totally agree.
Yeah, completely. But the only other thing really to mention is that, of course, the title of the chapter is A Bronze Bear, and the Bronze Bear is supposed to mark where the Borderlanders are in Camelin, and it seems interesting because not a great deal of time in the chapter is actually spent on them.
Wasn't the bear one of the sigils of one of the four young high seats? Wasn't it? One of them was Mantiar had eagles. Oh, I can't remember. But I thought one of them was a bear. Hyvan, maybe?
One of them is a blue bear.
A blue bear.
But yeah, the bronze bear on the map in the map room was to mark where the Borderlander camp was.
Okay, so the bear was just a coincidence then. You know, you get so used to everything meaning something that you almost forget that it's possible that something could just be, you know, similar without necessarily being connected. I have to say, I kind of like those young high seats, you know. They're all kind of interesting characters, and I hope that, you know, we'll see more of them later on. And I also hope we'll see more of Charles Gibbon. He pops up in these chapters briefly, and then again later in the book, and I hope that he'll have a much bigger role to play later on, because not only is he pretty to look at, but seems like he's got a lot of potential.
Yeah, and on top of that, he was actually named for a donation winner.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was pretty cool. Have we heard who the new ones are?
I do not remember if the names were published ever or not.
Of the winners. I mean, probably not the names that they'll be getting in the book, but I wonder if the people that won were posted. I don't remember reading it. If I did, I've forgotten.
Well, we will find them in less than a month.
yeah, a couple of weeks. I know it wasn't me. I can definitely say that. Well, we have any other comments on this last chapter or of the series of Elaine chapters?
Only this much. For those of you who are not the greatest Elaine fans, be thankful because this concludes the largest portion of time that we see Elaine in this entire book.
I wouldn't say that I'm not an Elaine fan. I do like Elaine, but I have to admit that there are some chapters in this section that I found to be a little tedious, and that may be a function of having reread them so many times that any little thing tends to kind of stick in your mind after a while. And if it's annoying, then it seems to be like a little stone in your shoe that just nags you and just kind of gets on your nerves. And I didn't care for most of these chapters. I didn't mind the last two, but I think Wet Things and the one previous to that was the ones that just, I mean, all I know is when we go from the Matt chapters and the Perrin chapters to the first scene in the Elaine chapters where she's screaming, "Push, push," to the guardsman on the wall, I'm going like, oh no.
Yeah, I've never had a problem with Elaine myself, but I have heard from numerous people who just really couldn't stand her as a character. And so for those individuals, your pain has been eased.
It's about to be over with for a while. Well, hopefully, you know, things will get a little bit better with Elaine now that she's so close to being, you know, actually crowned. She's got all the houses that she needs for support, and she's got her enemies pretty much under her thumb now. I guess the only thing we really have to look forward to is hoping for the grand coronation.
And the birth.
And the wedding. So, I guess that will pretty much wrap up this section of chapters. And we hope that we've managed to shed a little light on something or another for you.
Yes, definitely. If you see things that we haven't mentioned, or if you have any other theories or ideas based on what we've said or what we haven't said, of course there are a number of ways you can get a hold of us. You can always leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
Yes, we love to get voicemails. We do have a number of them that we're getting together once we finish this read-through that we'll be going into and playing on the show. And you can also reach us through traditional email, which is podcast@dragonmount.com.
On the Dragon Mount Fourth Age podcast page, after each individual episode is a comments section where you can leave ideas, and a number of us do frequent the comments sections, making clarifications or just, you know, bouncing back ideas with the listeners. In addition, we also have a Fourth Age forum section in the Dragon Mount forums, which is www.dragonmount.com/forums.
Yes, and you can also follow us on various of the social networking media. We have a Facebook page for the Fourth Age podcast, and we also have a MySpace account, which you can find by searching on either one of those for the Fourth Age podcast. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Fourth Age, all one word. Oh, and also, Dragon Mount, our host website, now has its own Facebook page, and you can also follow Dragon Mount on Twitter.
Definitely. We welcome everything we can get. As soon as we are finished with the recap of Knife of Dreams, we plan to try to bring back some of the good old sections of the podcast, including the crazy theories and listener feedback. So anything that you guys want to give us, be it comments, critique, criticism, crazy theories, good ideas, bad ideas, crazy ideas, you know, we love hearing from the listeners, and we try to get back to everyone as soon as we are able to.
Yes, crazy theories. I want crazy theories. Send them in, please. Call and leave us voicemails or do anything like that. We'd love to hear from you. And probably the quickest way to get a response from us is on email. One or two or maybe all of us might chime in at any time. We generally get back to people within a day. If you just happen to hit me at the right time, I my BlackBerry or my iPhone or whatever, you might get an email reply within mere moments. Once again, we'd like to thank you all very much for listening. We truly do appreciate it. We hope that this is interesting to you and that you find this as much fun as we do to do it. Like you, we're all fans of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time and now Brandon Sanderson, the custodian of the Wheel of Time. And we really appreciate you joining us in this exploration of this wonderful series of books. So until we meet again, may the light illumine you and bring you all the joy that is possible.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Sharavyan and Toman Shima, Taishite.
While you're doing that, I have to say, I had this thought on the way driving home. I was thinking about, of course, the Wheel of Time, and then I was thinking, of course, about, it's a new discovery to me, Dr. Horrible. I was thinking that the big shocking thing that's going to happen to Rand is he's going to wake up one morning singing, "It's a Brand New Day." "It's a brand new day, the sun is shining, and the birds are singing, cause you're gonna die." And he's going to do the whole Kinslayer.
I love that.
I know, he's going to do the whole Kinslayer trip on everybody. "Go ahead and laugh, yeah, I'm a funny guy."